Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This is a pre-recorded edition recorded on Wednesday afternoon. My guest will be Randy Dawn, pre-recorded last week. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Okay, so who's the monster here? In the new Austrian film Goodnight Mommy, which is coming out on home video on December 1st, young twin brothers Lucas and Elias, played by actual twin brothers Lucas and Elias Schwartz, are being held in isolation in a luxurious country house by their mother. Her face is swaddled in bandages, the blinds are perpetually closed, Dad is nowhere to be found, and the basement freezer is stocked with enough pepperoni pizza to last through several zombie apocalypses. And Mom, played by Suzanne West, isn't just acting like Mom. Maybe, the boys begin thinking, it's because she isn't actually Mom. But there are no boys, only boy, Elias, whose brother was killed in some unspecified accident that also disfigured their mother, destroyed her marriage, and devastated Elias to the point where he's conjured his departed sibling as an imaginary friend or, more dangerously, an enabling manifestation of his survivor's guilt. The home is not a prison, but a retreat intended to give Mommy time to heal from reconstructive surgery and allow her to wean Elias from his delusions. In Elias's case, the healing process isn't working, and directors Veronica Franz and Severin Fiala turn out to be virtuosos in concealing how severe that failure is until the film's final act. Goodnight Mommy is one of those films where you don't realize you've fallen down the rabbit hole until you see the floor rapidly approaching, and then it's too late. Two-thirds of the tale is sustained, low-key dread. The final act is remorseless culmination of that build-up. If you've seen Takashi Miike's Audition or the White Bear episode of the TV series Black Mirror, you know what you're in for. What makes the experience so radical is Franz's and Fiala's ability to take you inside Eliza's head, into a mind so traumatized by tragedy that it cannot reconcile how that tragedy has affected others, how the formerly loving mother might be transformed, might be as in need of healing, might be unaware of how profound her transformation may appear to a heretofore innocent mind. In Goodnight Mommy, it ain't the mad scientist making the monsters. It's the horrors of life itself, and no one's immune. But if you want more conventional monsters, let me recommend The Hallow, an Irish film that opened a couple of weeks ago, in which a conservationist moves his wife and infant child to a remote cabin and discovers the woods populated with the horrific manifestations of mythic forest-dwelling creatures, none of whom speak in iambic pentameter, but all of whom are intent on adding a new baby to their population. The film's nicely atmospheric, and director Corin Hardy even imbues his night dwellers with a certain portion of empathy. We're nowhere near the radical takes on the concerns of parenthood that The Babadook or Goodnight Mommy invoke, but The Hallow is good fun nevertheless. And while we're talking radical, this isn't genre fully, but if you're a child of the 60s or 50s or 70s, you might be interested in knowing that S'more Entertainment has released a disc set of The Great American Dream Machine, the innovative PBS series that mixed animated shorts, media satire, cinema verite, and experimental video into one delirious omnibus, and pretty much paved the way for Saturday Night Live, The Daily Show, Adult Swim, the GOP's ongoing enmity towards PBS. You can still see the face of the PBSP looking to the left at the end of each episode here, and pretty much the whole ironic media ecology that we now live in. A lot of it is crude from a production standpoint. This is pre-digital, after all. 16mm does hold sway here. Some of it is grievously dated, but it does stand very much as one of the last rousing examples of when broadcast TV was treated as a genuine laboratory, when rawness and unpredictability stood as representative of the revolution taking place over all aspects of American life. That spirit has gone to other conduits and has somehow turned into an endless stream of cat videos, but it's still rousing to see it in its nascent form. I'm Dan Persons. Remember to check out the latest episode of my bad movie podcast, Temple of Bad, focusing on the insane Mexican horror film, The Brainiac. You can catch it at the Mighty Movie Podcast website over at mightymoviepodcast.com.
November 1621. By now, the white man has arrived in great numbers, not only at Miami, but at Jamestown, at Plymouth, and at Salem, Massachusetts. The Puritans have established a thriving colony, enjoying all the social and cultural refinements of a modern society.
Hiya, Harv. Who are you taking to the witch burning Saturday night?
Prudence Adams. Who are you taking to the Rotary Club luncheon?
I haven't got a date yet, but I hear it's going to be quite a spread.
Well, Mayor Pennypacker, how's it look for re-election?
Great, great, great. Never looked better.
Yeah, what about the Indian vote?
What do you mean by that?
Well, you're not too popular with the Indians. They could lose you the election.
That's possible.
Well, they outnumber us.
Well, that's the trouble. You give them an inch and they take over.
But, Mayor, they were here before we were. We moved in on them.
So we did. Well, there's just something about them. They wear funny shoes. They don't even have buckles on them.
Be that as it may, election is Friday. You better make some gesture this week.
Like what?
Well, how about if you make a concession and pick an Indian as a running mate? You'd be sure to carry the Indian block.
What? Anything happened to me, you'd have a mayor that wasn't a Puritan. He'd probably take orders directly from Chief Powhatan.
Yeah.
Say, I got it. The big luncheon tomorrow. The one under the trees.
What about it?
We'll ask an Indian. That'll impress the rest of them.
We could even announce you're going to put one in your cabinet.
No need to go that far. Just have one to lunch.
It'll be great press.
Mayor Pennypacker comes out for equality. justice. Votes. What a slogan. Take an Indian to lunch this week. Show him we're a regular bunch this week. Show him we're as liberal as can be. Let him know he's almost as good as we. Make a feathered friend feel fed this week. Overlook the fact he's red this week. Let him share our Quaker oats, 'cause he's useful when he votes. Take an Indian to lunch.
2, 4, 6, 8, who do we tolerate? Indians, Indians, rah, rah, rah. Take an Indian to lunch this week. Let him sit right down and munch this week.
Let's give in and all do the brotherhood bit. Just make sure we don't make a habit of it. Take an Indian to dine this week. Show him we don't draw the line this week. We know everyone can't be as American as we. After all, we came over on the Mayflower. Take an Indian, not a wooden Indian, but a real life Indian to lunch.
And again, good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. And a couple of quick announcements. Number one, December 8th, mark your calendars and come on over to the very building where WBAI is at 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn and join us for our annual New York Review of Science Fiction family reading with couple Delia Sherman and Ellen Kushner. Going to be great. So please show up December 8th. We start at 7 p.m. There's the cafe, of course, so you can get stuff. And admission is free, though we will look cross-eyed at you to try to get donations. Speaking of Ellen Kushner and Delia Sherman, they have a person who they work with for publicity and various things, Randy Dawn, who I since discovered is quite a writer on her own. She appears on the Today.com website, as in the Today Show and various things like that. And she's done at least one movie review for us to complement the reviews that Dan Persons does. And, well, I thought it would be a wonderful idea to have her on. So here is a review recorded last week on Tuesday afternoon. Set your Wayback Machines and join us. It's about 2 in the afternoon, and it's November 17th of 2015, and I am Jim Freund. With me, Randy Dawn, who I guess I first knew you in association of work that you do with Ellen Kushner and or Delia Sherman?
Yes, yes, both and or. I'm do part-time assistant work with them right now, and they're sort of showing me the ropes of the actual publishing business while I'm working to get myself further published.
Okay, and yes, and more importantly, you're a writer, you're a film and TV critic, a media critic, really.
Right, that's my main thing. I started out doing nonfiction writing because somebody would pay me to write that stuff.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, I have written plenty of fiction that people have not yet paid me for. So.
Yeah, no, I've done my share of nonfiction writing, but it's about computers and technology.
Right,
and
right.
All that good stuff. And right now, my partner is upstairs editing Computer World magazine is what she does.
Right, so, yeah. You got to do something that'll pay the bills.
And she's also a science fiction writer.
Right.
I've just wanted to make this happen, and
yeah,
we discovered
thank
that
you.
We live in the same unnamed portion of Brooklyn.
That's right. All right. It's the unnamed Brooklyn section.
Yes, yes. For those who want to look it up, it's under unnamed.
Exactly. No, yeah, it turns out we're practically neighbors, and we are neighbors, I guess you consider it that
way. Yeah, yeah.
I've only been here for 2 years, but you've been here a lot longer.
20 years now, but yeah. We were neighbors without knowing it.
That's right, that, in Jackson Heights.
In Jackson Heights, Queens, which used to be my unnamed place.
Uh-huh.
But since I haven't lived there in 20 years.
You can lift the veil.
I can lift the veil, but my first 40 years were in two different apartments, my parents' apartment and then my own in Jackson Heights. I love Jackson Heights.
I really did too. You know, it wasn't that it wasn't voluntary to leave, but it was not a choice per se. Given my druthers, I would still be in Jackson Heights. And nothing against Brooklyn, but I like Jackson Heights a lot. It was quieter. People didn't yell at each other on the streets quite as much.
Yeah, well, it depends on the part of the unnamed neighborhood you're in.
That's true.
This is actually the fact that we can record here.
That's true. You have a little nook that is, you know,
yeah.
Nice.
Whereas where WBAI is on Atlantic Avenue is one of the noisiest bleeping. By the way, there's a good word. We were talking off the air about what words you can use.
Right.
I use the word bleeping all the bleeping time.
You know, I was a big fan of the radio show Loveline for a long time. And when they started using, well, F that or S that, I just would die laughing because I thought that was so funny. So I that's where I tend to go as opposed to bleeping.
So they actually say F that.
Yeah, exactly.
Because
it's radio and all that. They won't use the actual words, but when one of the hosts would use that, it would just make me, I would just crack up. That was very funny to me.
Yeah. We're not as free. There was a time before Carlin, and especially given a fiction show where writers come on and read their work, it's very, very important to me to have the freedom with, not necessarily in conversation.
Right.
Because that is gratuitous language is the legal phrase.
Right.
Right. But within the context of a story, if that carries weight, you need to have that weight.
Right.
And occasionally I will still, you know, get to the program director or station manager or somebody in power and say, this story doesn't broadcast without that word.
Oh, okay.
Shall we not broadcast that story at, you know, 3 a.m., 5 a.m., whenever? Actually, I used to be starting at 5. It's
right.
Just really like, no, there are not kids who don't understand disclaimers listening then.
At 5 in the morning, even the people who've tried to stay up all night are starting to fade.
Yeah, and this show is on for 39 years at 5 a.m.,
yep,
which is still my favorite time slot.
Oh, okay.
Still.
When I did radio for my college, I went to Boston University, so we had carrier current radio. We didn't have proper radio. I had the 1 to 4 a.m. slot. And then I had a 7 a.m. class, and so it was only once a week, but my RA would let me stay on his floor. So I'd go from the radio station up a couple flights, because it was in the dorm, it was in one of the dorms, and I'd go up a couple flights. He'd leave the door unlocked. I'd go in, I'd crash out on the floor and get up for a 7 a.m. Spanish class and be like, hello, hola.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Yeah, I guess if the station survives and if I ever end up on Tuesday nights, I can go from the New York Review of Science Fiction readings right upstairs. and yeah, because the station's on the third floor of the same building.
Yeah.
But, and ironically, the cafe where we do the readings has better soundproofing than the radio station itself. We have no soundproofing.
Right.
Which is why it's better here in an unnamed neighborhood.
Yes.
So, what kind of writing do you generally do?
You know, it's really, I feel like I don't want to say that I'm omnivorous or whatever the equivalent of that would be for somebody who writes.
I like
whatever.
Omnivorous.
Okay. But I will write a lot of different kinds of things. As a not majorly published fiction writer at this point, I've jumped around in a lot of genres. I have several novels that are crime fiction, with a big arc that carries through the first three, and then for some reason in the fourth one it went very paranormal. But I've also always been attracted to fantasy, science fiction, apocalyptic those kind of stories as well. I grew up in the 1980s, and so I was kind of surrounded by this Cold War concept of you may die at any moment in a horrible flash of light, and if you don't, you're going to live your rest of your life as an irradiated being crawling around.
Yeah, that was the Renaissance. I grew up, I'm born in 1953.
Yeah, okay, right.
So
so that's like Cold War paranoia, Russians era, no?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That is any moment is the mushroom-shaped cloud.
Yeah, yeah. And
anytime. And we're in the third wave now.
Yes, when anybody could be irradiated at any moment, but it probably won't be from the Russians. It'll be from some secret.
Well, now it's no longer irradiated. Now it's somebody will just walk into the sports arena where you are and machine gun everybody.
Right, right.
You know, and it doesn't have to be... Mm-hmm. From outside of the U.S.
Yeah.
It could be, you know, during a Batman movie.
But this also kind of started, what was interesting is I got...
From a good old American.
Right, exactly. Right, exactly.
We don't need to...
Although the last...
Import terrorists, we have our own domestic.
Right. Of course, the last Batman prior to the current Batman who's still coming up was not American at all. He was British. Christian Bale, yeah.
Oh, yes, but I was talking about the massacre during the Dark Knight Rises.
Oh, right, of course.
And he was from Colorado.
Yes, right, exactly.
So I wasn't thinking of the actors, I was thinking of the killer.
Okay.
the real life one, right. And not Heath Ledger or...
Or Tom Hardy, wasn't he Bane?
I guess so.
Yeah, anyway.
I preferred the Tim Burton movies myself.
Oh, okay. Okay. But yeah,
I like comedy in my comics.
Yes, why not? I'm very much of the dark side. I like the dark stuff. And
as you said, you grew up during the 80s.
Well, not only that, also I grew up in the 70s, and there was mostly 70s, and then also in the 80s. But there was a show that used to be on called In Search Of, with Leonard Nimoy, and the one that I remember the best. Was, of course, this is complete nonsense, but he did a whole show about in such and such a day in 1980, all the planets are going to line up and there will be mass earthquakes and tsunamis and the world will basically crack apart at the seams. And I'm hearing this and I'm still in my single digits and I have this concept of, what do you mean the world could end?
Yes.
What am I going to do with all my stuffed animals? You know, it was a big subject matter. Even before we get to the
Cold War, so that is you put them on our staircase,
right? Exactly, you line the staircase with the stuffed animals, and so I think this just planted a seed in me of, wow, the world actually could end, and then it started feeding into the actually, okay, the planets didn't line up, the world did not end, but by the way, there's this thing called the Cold War, and we have nuclear weapons, and they have nuclear weapons, and then I started watching all of these. I think Australia had a really good run with apocalyptic movies, between the Mad Max ones, but Peter Weir's The Last Wave.
Mm-hmm.
We had a very early version.
My favorite one is from New Zealand.
The Quiet Earth?
The Quiet Earth.
Oh, that's
gorgeous. Not a well-known film.
No, but a gorgeous film.
Pretty obscure, brilliant film. I loved it.
The actor Bruno Heller, I want to say is his name. He's amazing. He's been in several different...
No, Bruno Ganz is...
Bruno Ganz.
No, that's a different...
Ganz is Werner Herzog, isn't it?
He's Werner Herzog. He's the angel in...
Oh, in
I'm always...
Wings of Desire.
Yeah, one of my favorite
also
all-time
a beautiful movie. Magical realism piece of filmmaking, absolutely. We had a very early
and
version
who knew
of...
about Peter Falk, but
yeah,
that's
I know
a spoiler.
Yeah, that was a dark horse right there. But we had this early version of cable, and it was basically with the box on top of your TV set, and it was either on or off, and there was one channel, and the movie
channel
came... something like that. It was called Super TV, is what it was called.
Oh, that's
so you put on your TV on Channel 3.
So this wasn't New York?
No, this is Maryland. I grew up in Maryland.
Okay, because in New York there was Channel H.
Oh,
and
okay.
Today we call it HBO.
Oh, I didn't know that there was a prototype. Okay, I didn't know there was H and then that became HBO.
Yeah, that was the one cable channel.
Oh,
it was Channel H,
okay.
And that became HBO.
Oh, right. I don't think Super TV was specific only to Maryland, but it may or may not have been nationwide.
I think Super TV was actually run by Turner. I think that it was.
Oh, okay.
I think it was a local broadcast channel from Atlanta.
Okay.
That was the first
to be nationally syndicated.
Okay. I always thought of...
In that manner.
Right. I always thought of him as... I mean, it's entirely possible. I always thought of him as basically owning, like, TBS and TBS.
That's later.
His thing. Okay.
That's later.
So maybe this was early.
First, he had the Superstation, it was called.
Right.
And it was the Atlanta Channel, but it was in every market in the U.S. In the proto days.
Right.
And then later on, he built up TBS, TNT, the one with which I cannot live without, which is TCM, and which is Turner Classic Movies.
Mm-hmm. Great,
so when I turn, most people, when they turn on their TV, it goes to like CNN or the news. In this household, it goes on to
TCM.
Turner Classic Movies.
Right.
Live for old movies.
And they don't cut them, which is also very nice.
Yes, yeah, as they say, uncut and no commercials.
No commercials, right.
At any point. Yeah.
But anyway, so we would have this channel, and this was, I was quite young. I was not nine or ten, but they showed a lot of these old, they didn't have a lot of really big, tiny movies, because that's what HBO was getting. You know, it was already, you know, they were siphoning off the really good stuff. So I got a lot of independent and foreign films that I wouldn't have normally seen at a fairly young age. You know, I did not live in a super sophisticated household where it was like, oh, here's Godard and you're seven, you know. So I ended up watching a lot of these movies that were Australian and New Zealand. And the thing is, you could see them over and over again because they would have a whole month where maybe they had seven films and it was just on at various different times.
Yeah.
I saw James Bond. There was the James Bond movie out at the time, For Your Eyes Only. And it wasn't even one of the good ones, but I think I saw it seven or eight times.
Mm-hmm.
And these I saw Gallipoli. I saw a lot of really great Australian cinema. And it almost always seemed to be somehow, and the world's going to end. So again, that was just sort of pushing me in this direction. And then somehow I got a videotape somebody loaned me of Threads, which was really the most horrific thing I think I've still ever seen about the apocalypse and post-apocalyptic. Probably if I watched it today, it would look very tacky, but it really...
I thought it was slightly tacky then, but that may have depended on...
My eyes would have been seeing it differently, I think.
I think so, yeah. Also, yeah. And I was also looking at the science of it.
Right, yeah, and I
didn't know. And the science was pretty bad.
I just remember how at the very end they show you like a generation on and people have mutated, and that freaked me out.
Yeah.
So I just got really into this sort of storytelling early on, and that seemed to bleed into science fiction, which bled into fantasy, which bled into horror. They all just felt like companions in the same household, and I was happy to sit with any of them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much great fiction out there. And then it felt like it exploded. Oh, there's all this really great apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic and pre-apocalyptic and alternate universe apocalyptic type stuff that's out there. And you can read too much of it.
Yeah, my last interview was last week with John Joseph Adams.
Oh, right. Okay. So.
And, you know, talk about somebody who is stuck on none. The only time he's not doing apocalyptic anthologies or stories in one of his two magazines, he's doing zombies.
Ah, okay.
Yes. You know, which is still apocalyptic. It's still, you're dead.
Yeah, exactly.
And either, you know, either way you do it, you're dead.
Yeah. I don't know how old John is. I'm imagining he's a little younger than I am at the very least, but I think that it's a mindset too. And I'm wondering how much of it comes into, I'm very interested in not becoming a survivalist. I'm not going to have a year's worth of rations in the basement necessarily, but I like the idea. It is appealing to me, the idea of being independent, being able to take care of yourself if things get dire. And that's why I always felt when I was watching these movies or reading these stories that I was somehow learning methods, picking up details, finding out how maybe I would do it in this situation. There was another movie that I saw on Super TV, which was not in any way apocalyptic, but it was New Zealand. New Zealand? Was that? I think it was New Zealand. Roger Donaldson did a movie called Smash Palace, which is really about a couple who are just, they hate each other.
I remember the title.
She sleeps with the best friend of her husband. But there's a small part of it toward the end in which the father.
Is Roger Donaldson, he's not a Kiwi, is he?
He is, actually.
Because he's done a lot of American films.
He has, but he's a Kiwi, absolutely.
Ah, okay.
And I think Bruno is actually in this film. I think he's the dad. We were just talking to Bruno a minute ago.
Uh-huh.
I think he's the dad. I would have to check on that. Anyway, towards the very end, he kidnaps his own daughter and takes her out to the bush. And it's like, we're going to live in the bush. You're never going to see them again. We're going to just live out here. And it's a very small part of the story because she very quickly gets like a cold or something. And then he takes her to the pharmacist and then they are discovered and the rest of the movie plays out. But that stuck with me. First of all, I was probably closer to the girl's age than I was the father's. But the idea of what turned in my head was, well, what if they didn't leave? And I have a whole novel that I'm doing a rewrite on now about, well, what if they didn't leave, but were discovered years later?
Mm-hmm.
So I became very interested in people who live in the woods, hermits in the woods, people who just drop out of society. And again, it kind of all comes together again with this survivalistic interest of how do you survive in the woods? How do you survive after an apocalypse? How do you get away? And I still have this dream of wanting to have a cabin in the woods when we all retire.
Right.
And you know, maybe get solar panels and live off the grid.
Yeah, no, I think you're right that there's a generational thing going on. The funny thing is, as I'm growing up through the real, the real Cold War,
mm-hmm.
because, yes, there's a lot of post-apocalyptic stuff in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
My generation, we get Dr. Strangelove. That's it. It's boom. It's gone. There is...
And Failsafe. You get Failsafe also.
And Failsafe, yeah. Exactly. And with Failsafe, there is a post-apocalypse. But in Dr. Strangelove, that's it for the Earth.
Right, that's...
And in much of the apocalyptic science fiction of the atomic era,
mm-hmm.
is bango, goodbye, not what will you do after. Right. There is no after.
Right, it's a glassed over planet, essentially.
Yeah, that's it. Or as George Stewart, Earth abides, you know.
Yeah,
won't, but yeah. Earth abides. Mm-hmm. And it continues. The later era, the darker, which is really the darker, there was also a lot of humor,
mm-hmm.
in the apocalyptic fiction, the Richard Matheson stories, Robert Bloch, and all of these horror writers of the Alfred Hitchcock era and Twilight Zone era and all that. There's a lot of comedy in there.
Mm-hmm.
And there really isn't today.
Mm, do you think that if it's not in there today, that it's humorless, which makes it sound like it's a little bit too serious for itself?
From my personal point of view, mm-hmm. as an older person,
mm-hmm.
yes. I find a lot of the stuff grim to the point of I don't necessarily want to watch all this darkness.
Right.
I don't mind seeing the dark side. I love dark humor, black comedy, and all that. But some humor in there is helpful.
Yeah.
When I take a look, and here's the biggest difference for me in the world of comics.
Mm-hmm.
Marvel has comedy.
Mm.
There's always a gag in a Marvel, with the exception of Daredevil, the Netflix production. There's a lot of comedy and a lot of humor in there. The DC world, the Batman world, and all that is just, oh my God. And there's the difference between the Tim Burton Batman and the Christopher Nolan Batman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the... named The Dark Knight, even though it has nothing to do with the Dark Knight graphic novels from which the title comes.
Right.
And if you want to talk about severe,
yes.
the Dark Knight, the original comic book, is about as dark as one can possibly get.
Mm.
It's nasty, you know. And then he went on to write Watchmen, Alan Moore.
Alan Moore, right.
Yeah. And so forth. So, yeah, I find a deep darkness that is unrelenting. And having, we were talking off air, I worked on the audiobook version of the sequel to John Joseph Adams' Wastelands, Wastelands 2, mm-hmm. which has a lot of really good stories in it, but a lot of them, and when I was talking about this with John last week, mm-hmm. he was saying, yeah, don't keep any razor blades nearby. And that's right.
Yeah.
There are exceptional stories mm-hmm. in there. Tanarive Due has one that is just called Patient Zero, and there are a few that just stick with me that are just sheer genius mm-hmm. in the way they are done. And a lot of them are just, you know, redneck pastiches.
So this is like it's like Daryl from Walking Dead type redneck pastiche?
Now, you see, I won't watch Walking Dead. I have never seen Walking Dead.
Well, you probably shouldn't, just because, and I'm not necessarily not with you either, mm-hmm. but if you want lack of humor, that would be the story, that would be the show to watch. There's zero humor.
That's exactly why. And it's a serial. It's a never-ending serial. I have problems with many shows that go off in 90 splinters.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That will never come back together. I mean,
oh, I see what you're saying.
Famously, Lost got lost.
Yeah.
There was a point that the New York Times counted 72 storylines mm-hmm. on Lost as it was entering its final season.
Right.
And they never really did manage to bring them back together into one cohesive thing.
That's because they didn't know what they were doing until they were in the middle of doing it.
And it changes, well, yeah. not even that, because what happens, and this is the reality, is they change showrunners all the time.
Well, Cuse and Lindelof were there for, I think, the vast majority of it. I know J.J. Abrams took his hand out pretty
quickly. Yeah, well, but it was his show.
It was his show, but he got out pretty quickly, and I think Cuse and Lindelof had it. Carlton Cuse and Damon Lindelof, in case there's anybody here who might be listening to this and doesn't know. My guess is that they were with it throughout most of it. I remember talking to them probably about third or fourth season, and I was trying to extract from them at least the concept. They had some idea where they were going, and they were very good at blustering about it, but it...
Yeah, but they didn't.
They didn't.
My favorite Carlton Cuse thing, mm-hmm. Briscoe County Jr.
Well,
there's a show nobody knows.
You can't fault the man.
And that I loved it.
Okay.
I love Bruce Campbell Western with science fiction darkness over the entire thing.
Right.
The Globe and John Astin popping up every two or three episodes.
Right.
Tongue in cheek beyond ash.
Do you think, though, that on some level... that maybe it's all a cyclical thing? I mean, that we go from there's some funny and then there's almost too much funny. I mean, when you talk Batman, a lot of people still think of the 60s Batman, Adam West, and that was just too silly.
Yeah.
And then we move into Dark Knight, and Dark Knight does persist for a while, but don't you think that at some point we're going to get more cyclical and things, there will be more humor brought in because it'll feel fresh.
I think so. Well, I think that it always reflects its era. Mm-hmm. I think that the current lack of happiness and post-apocalyptic stuff. Another word for it is post 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's one of the reasons that they say zombies are the thing now, is that zombies are the equivalent, the metaphorical equivalent of the suicide bomber. They're relentless. They keep coming. There's more of them and you can't stop them. And
and that's very true in today's news.
Right. So, I'm not trying to say that, you know, I'm not trying to equate a religion in this area. I hope nobody's offended out there. But this is the metaphorical theory that the vampires fit a particular political situation. And we've kind of moved beyond that situation.
Well, there are many existing religions today mm-hmm. that are apocalyptic religions.
Oh,
the
sure.
Seventh-day Adventists. Mm-hmm. The world ended... when was it? 19...
You're beyond the scope for me.
12 or something like that.
Okay.
In my lifetime, mm-hmm. there have been 5 or 6 apocalypses
mm-hmm.
that have been predicted, happened, people that committed suicide because of the impending apocalypse that was going to happen
right.
the next day.
Right.
We had one, the Mayan apocalypse last year.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was one that was there was a small splinter group that was actually calling for it happening sometime, I think, a month or two ago.
Oh, yeah, but that was a carryover when their first apocalypse happen. They said, oh, no, we got the math wrong.
I read the tea leaves wrong.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You know, it's
there's always an apocalypse on the horizon. There are, so, you know, you can't offend religions that, it's, we're not making this stuff up.
No, but I think it goes back to, this is why we're seeing the zombies, the persistence of zombies, and why there's that interest. But I want to like The Walking Dead a lot more than I do. But I think that story-wise, they're falling into the same problems that a lot of procedurals fall into, which is that it's rinse and repeat and rinse and repeat. And here are our heroes, and you think they found a place where they can survive, and then the rest of the season has how it slowly becomes a piece of S. You know, it all crumbles and falls apart, and now we have to move on again, and we're all embittered all over again, but we're moving. And, you know, it's on, what, season five, season six at this point? And what frustrates me is what feels like a lack of progression in actually telling the story. You've kind of established us with mostly these main characters. Some have come and some have go. But you're essentially the same as a Law and Order at this point, because you are predictable in the overall arc that you are currently
telling.
There's
one big difference between a lot of the apocalypse shows and modern TV. This is another trend I really dislike.
Okay.
And I totally blame Joss Whedon for starting this off. Killing beloved characters. That anybody can die at any time. And Joss Whedon, I think, started that in the later years with Buffy just poking out Xander's eyes for no reason at all.
I haven't gotten to that season yet. It's okay. It's a 20-year-old show at this point.
There's
no spoiler alerts needed. I understand.
Yes, various characters.
Yeah.
Just, you know, kicking the bucket. And then he got to doing that. He didn't do that during Firefly. He just did it in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Killing off two characters in Serenity.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them. Both of them, as far as I'm concerned, totally gratuitous. And the only reason he doesn't do that in his Marvel universes is he doesn't own the characters.
Oh, that's right. Right. Well, number one, don't ever say anything bad about Joss Whedon. No, it's okay.
I just did.
I'm walking out right now. Here's the thing is, as with anything that has never been done before or is rarely done in a story, when you do it too much, it loses the emotional impact that it had in the first place.
Yeah.
So I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with somebody saying, you know what, I could really F with people if I killed this one.
Mm-hmm.
Because they won't see that one coming.
That's exactly it. They're doing it for the shock value.
You know, as good as Game of Thrones is, it still rides on the shock wave of, they killed Ned!
You know, I stopped watching it before Ned died. Well, for one thing, I knew Ned was going to die.
Okay, yeah.
I'd read the first book and not beyond that. But I also have a very low tolerance for on-screen visceral gore.
Right. I just look away.
So, I can probably look away, except they film it in such a manner they know that you're going to look away. And so at the point that you're going to look away, and I come back to it, they then cut back, because they've shown the person die,
right?
And then it's like, okay, that's done with, I can look. And then they cut away again to show, like, arterial spurting. and that's an actual thing from Game of Thrones in, like, episode 6, where there's a courtyard fight.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they got one guy in the neck, and I had looked away because I knew to look away as I saw the sword being hefted, and I knew that he was going to get it because that one couldn't live. And I look away, I look back, and now we see the close-up of the dead guy's neck, and you see an artery vein opening and closing, spurting blood. That's gratuitous.
Yeah. No, it totally is. The show, there's a lot about that show that is gratuitous.
And that's why I can't watch the show. And, you know, so I love George Martin. I love his writing.
Well, I still, though, I mean, that's probably the last book I've read where I actually jaw-dropped when the Ned thing happened. Because the truth is, I like fantasy, but I'm not so much into high fantasy.
Yeah.
And I had gotten the book as a freebie. I went to a convention in California, and I was picking through all the stuff I have to bring back because they give you so much swag at this thing. And I'm like, well, I'll take this book. I can read it on the airplane. If I don't like it, I can just. And they'd given, it was right before the first season of the show started. HBO gave us the copy of the book.
Okay.
And I picked it up and I started reading it.
Although when the show started, I think the third book was already out, right?
Yeah, I mean, these books were already out, but they gave us the very first entry in the series.
I was just trying to remember the sequence. Yeah.
Because the show was about to start. And it was brilliant that they did. I got this in January. And I flew back in January. I was going to Aresia directly from this event.
Mm-hmm.
And I read it I was reading it on the plane. And when they killed him off, I was like, that's going to be a dream. That's going to be a flat. That's not right. Somebody else was at, it's actually somebody else's neck. And I couldn't believe that they didn't go back and fix this. And that hooked. That really hooked me because I was not as well acquainted with the random individuals getting killed who are not supposed to get killed sort of thing yet. And I ended up reading all of the books. I think the show started in June, approximately, maybe May. I had gone through every single book I read every book one a month until the show started.
Mm-hmm.
It completely blew me away. And it works because I wasn't inured to it yet. But that sort of thing is not something everybody can do all the time, because then it just becomes like, okay, so of these people they've just presented us, that's the one that would be most horrific to kill off early on. Oh, he's going to go. I want to invest in him.
Yeah.
And then you lose the audience before you've even done the thing that you may or may not even do.
This is why I'm not enamored of a lot of book series, a lot of TV,
mm-hmm.
Because this is the current trend.
Mm-hmm.
And George has a lot to answer for because he did it the best.
He did do it the best, I gotta say. I don't necessarily feel that Walking Dead, just going back to that one, it does kill off people, but at this point, the only person I think they could really kill off where people would leave in droves is our lead actor,
mm-hmm.
Played by Andrew Lincoln. If they get rid of Rick, then it becomes kind of a different show. A, mm-hmm. he's been with us from the beginning. He's our POV person. You know, he's the guy. And it's not that the show couldn't survive without him,
mm-hmm.
but that would be a hard one to that'd be a hard tooth to
but that out. Might that might be where there may come a certain point where the showrunner wants to go and they say, okay, let's make it a new show.
Oh, they've gone through three different showrunners since they started already.
But I'm saying, you know, that they could.
Yeah. Well, Lincoln himself will probably want to go at some point, and then the show will want to continue and they'll figure it out. But
I usually figure a lot of these things out by looking at IMDb. And saying, okay, how long is this contract?
That's right, exactly.
Okay. Where all these stupid newspaper headlines are going on, will Peter Capaldi leave Doctor Who? No, he's listed on IMDb as having a 3-year contract. So,
right.
You know, say what you want, he's going to get paid, and they're going to use him.
Right. Well, we kind of have become our own spoiler alerts in some ways. We're so used to not wanting to flinch that we pre-look ahead, and whether or not it's good for the entertainment industry, for our storytelling or not, it's hard to know. But, you know, you want to know if Capaldi's going to leave. Well, I know how I can figure that out. If I want to know if Andrew Lincoln is going to leave, I don't think he's going to. And part of that is that he's not really doing very much otherwise. It's not like, oh, when they're not filming, he's off making Oscar-winning movies and preparing, laying the groundwork for the next great, incursion. That's not a slam at him at all. If you've got a great job, there's not necessarily a need to go off and find four more.
Well, you never know. I mean, some people...
But people do that.
They do that. I mean, there are people who have dream roles, mm-hmm. on dream series, and they just walk away. They yep. just leave at the wrong time. And 5 years later, 30 years later, we're laughing at Denise Crosby for leaving Next Generation mm-hmm. to go out and make a name for herself. Well, right. sorry, but
that wasn't
Lieutenant
happening.
Yar was able to make one episode after that, mm-hmm. a very good one, years after she left.
Yeah.
I'm sure I could think of other examples, but it does happen that people do that. The only one that I can think of who was really successful at walking off a show at their height mm-hmm. and making something of themselves is George Clooney leaving ER.
Right.
And even then, he made some very bad moves mm-hmm. To begin with. We were talking about Batman earlier.
Oh, right. That's not one of the fun ones.
The single worst Batman movie stars George Clooney.
Well, look, you don't take the best looking actor in America and cover his face. I'm just saying.
it would be nice if you wrote a script, and it would be nice if you didn't put Arnold Schwarzenegger in there, and a Robin that never worked, and a really bad Batgirl.
Yeah, well, that movie would just felt like, how much more stuff
and
can
Poison
we pile
Harvey.
In
yeah,
here?
It was but Tim Burton left after two episodes, and probably for the best, because for a while, he kept doing good stuff.
Yeah. Well, franchises, I think, are one of these challenging things, because once you establish you have a character that can be rotated in and out, depending on who's playing them. You get Batman. One of my other favorite long-running franchises is the James Bond ones.
Yeah.
And once you've established that you can rotate someone in or not, then you actually have something that really can work in a lot of ways, but you've got to get somebody who's going to stick with it for a little bit.
Yeah, but they can sometimes... Sorry, Roger Moore never did it for me.
There's your humor. Don't you want more humor in things? He brought humor.
There is no lack of humor in the Sean Connery movies.
Right.
It's very wry humor. There's a bad pun in every film. Pardon my partner, she's just dead. There is lots of humor in all the early Bond films, and the darkest ending of any Bond film is On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Right.
George Lazenby, and what makes it worse is that it was Diana, who for me, of a certain age,
She's the one. Yeah,
it's her and Jane Fonda, and those are my icons when I was growing up.
Do we even have time to get into Bond? Because I could totally get into Bond with you on this.
We have a little.
Oh, okay,
I haven't seen Spectre yet.
I did. I saw Spectre.
Uh huh.
It's no Casino Royale, but it ain't Quantum of Solace. Let's put it that way.
Well, you see, I've got a thing about that series.
Since Craig came in, or just the series?
When I say the series, I mean the Daniel Craig series.
Okay, the Craig era.
Yeah.
Okay.
To me, it's the arc that Paul Haggis created and was pulled away from.
Mm-hmm.
And why was he pulled away? Scientology.
Well, he learned better, didn't he?
Well, no, it's because he walked out of Scientology.
Right.
He had a trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody seems to forget that Casino Royale, which is the first Bond novel, was a reboot.
Right.
And so he's going back, pardon me, Casino Royale is his second assignment ever. It's stated in the movie.
Yeah.
He's just gotten his 00 number.
And it makes it very interesting and fresh.
It does. And it is totally fresh. It is a totally new look at Bond. And it's an exceedingly clever, well-done movie.
Mm-hmm.
To me, Quantum of Solace has the problems of any trilogy of the second one. Two Towers, that holds up, but that wasn't supposed to be a trilogy. Lord of the Rings was one novel that the publisher broke up into three parts. Empire Strikes Back was pretty good, but for me, Star Wars, I understand later they called it A New Hope.
Yeah.
Star Wars was the film.
Yeah.
Nobody had ever seen anything like Star Wars before it happened. Empire Strikes Back is probably the better movie, but Star Wars is the one that changed the industry.
Right.
But Paul Haggis was writing a trilogy, mm-hmm. and he had a trilogy in mind where at the end of the first film, which didn't have any of the James Bond trappings, it's at the capper mm-hmm. of the first film, is that he shoots a guy who had caused Vesper's death, spoilers, and then the guy says, "Who are you?" And he says, "Bond."
James Bond.
James Bond.
Well, for what it's worth, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. The second film mm-hmm. then starts to bring in a few of the other tropes. He gets his Walther and then...
PPK,
thank you. And it's not totally done. And Quantum of Solace, one of the, you know, is so dark, and so what it is he's still in the throes of Vesper's death.
Yeah.
The whole thing is going to get wrapped up in the big third movie that he had planned, in which he was going to do what does end up happening in Skyfall. Problem is, that's the point when he not only left Scientology, mm-hmm. but it was written up in The New Yorker by
didn't he write
Lawrence
himself?
Wright.
Oh, okay. I thought he wrote it himself.
No, Haggis. Lawrence Wright wrote an article in The New Yorker, which then became a book called Going Clear.
Oh, right. Okay.
Which is then made into a movie by Alex Gibney.
Yes.
But no, Lawrence Wright wrote this, the Pulitzer Prize winning writer. Mm-hmm. Haggis never wrote anything.
Well, Haggis did write something about why he left Scientology.
He wrote a letter to...
Okay.
No. He wrote a letter to Scientology about why he was leaving, and he made it a public letter
That
everybody in Scientology could read.
Okay.
He never published a word.
Okay.
Not a word to this day. Okay. He's never written about it except to the church, so-called church, itself. Everything else is written about it, and he's, of course, interviewed in it because he's in the movie, mm-hmm. And I could get into that whole topic.
Yeah, that's different.
Now, nobody has ever written or said, except me, that this is why the Bond films fall apart. Mm. But the timing is too good. Mm. And at the end of the original article by Lawrence Wright, which, by the way, is available online for free, and so people can read it, and at the end of the article is what's going to happen. And Haggis says, you know, you'll probably read about, you know, some scandal or something. And that didn't happen. But what did happen is he fell off the face of the Hollywood planet mm-hmm. Hollywood, as mm-hmm. it were, for a while. He never got to make the third movie of his trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Quantum of Solace, especially, I think people would have forgiven Quantum of Solace had he finished his trilogy.
Well, for what it's worth, and you know more about the trilogy aspect of this than I do, Spectre does bring it all back around again. The stuff that gets started in Casino Royale is directly addressed in Spectre.
Yeah, I think that his treatment is mm-hmm. probably still in Skyfall,
mm-hmm.
and I think he wanted to end it with the third movie, but now it's been handed over to Neil Purvis and other people.
Right.
And yeah, I don't know about the whole Blofeld thing. And no, I haven't seen Spectre, but come on. The name of the movie is Spectre. Who do we think?
If you want, I will say something. If you do not want, I will not say something. And maybe people listening don't want me to say something, so I will not say something.
Blofeld is actually Bond's twin brother. No. But actually, that's not far off the mark.
Should I say anything?
Oh, spoiler. Sure, go ahead.
Not twin, but there's a brother relationship.
Yes,
but it's that's
also. See, I already actually knew that, even though I haven't seen the film. It's
right.
Yeah, it's the internet.
But that's also classic Jungian storytelling too. You know, the your opposite self and all of that and so forth. So that's not a huge leap to make, but it was interesting to me because this is clearly not a depth to which the other films had aspired. It was just, here's your nemesis. We can't seem to get rid of him. He's a fun character. We keep bringing him back, even though you...
And that's fine. I don't have any problem with that.
Yeah, no, neither do I.
But that they had to go the Jungian, Freudian route and all that,
uh-huh.
Beyond the idea of M as his mother and all of that. I thought that was fairly well handled, and that was being set up by Paul Haggis to begin with. And I thought they did a superb job with Skyfall. I just wanted to see what the person who had come up with the idea would have done with it.
Right.
And so I felt a little disappointed that we never got to see the plan. And so I see Quantum of Solace as not a totally failed film, but as something that was setting up material that we don't know exactly what the setup was, because then the last part of the trilogy got turned over to somebody else.
Right. Right. That's a good theory.
It's a theory. It's not knowledge.
Right. I will say that as a whole, I have enjoyed the Daniel Craig movies equally to at least to the Connery ones. Mm-hmm. The big soft middle is very much a soft middle. There are some more ones I enjoyed, and Dalton.
I like The Spy Who Loved Me. It's fun.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of them in there that I have no problem with. They started relying too much on chase sequences.
But there's a couple.
But there's a couple in there that I have no problem with.
And some of them become silly slapstick.
Yeah, and you know, once you start getting into that Louisiana sheriff who keeps showing up. That's when you start getting into, you want to just put the Benny Hill music on or something.
And then I'm the one who liked Timothy Dalton.
Wow.
You didn't.
This is a whole other conversation, I think, because Dalton is the only Bond.
I said I'm the one.
Yeah, you are, because he's the only one I ever actually fell asleep to in the middle of a Bond movie. I never fell asleep in the middle of a Bond
movie. I liked License to Kill. I thought it was well written. I thought he was a good Bond. And he was the first dark Bond.
Yeah.
People forget that. You know, they say, oh, Daniel Craig brings all this darkness. Actually, Daniel Craig is nowhere near as dark as Timothy Dalton was. And I didn't care for the second film that much with Dalton. But the first one, I thought he was promising. And I think, by the way, George Lazenby was very underrated.
You know, I agree, and I almost had this conversation online the other day, but, you know, you can only talk but so much on Facebook. As a movie, pre-Daniel Craig, I'll say, as a movie, I feel Her Majesty's Secret Service holds up the best of all the Bond movies. It is a movie with a beginning, middle, and an end. These other ones are all meant to be continuing.
They're set piece after set piece, yeah.
You know, Lazenby, I think, I had no
except
problem with
that whole Alpine sequence you could cut out and the movie wouldn't change at all.
That was the beginning of the chase sequences getting too long.
Yeah.
Because you went to speedboat scenes, you went to the car scenes, and then the Alpine scenes. There's at least another Alpine scene in another film that
actually in The Lodge, where Blofeld is trying to prove his lineage and all of that stuff.
Oh, okay.
And that's about a 45-minute
It's been a while since I saw it. I gotta
admit. Well, they're all, most of them are over 2 hours.
Yeah.
And Skyfall, and rather, Spectre is the longest Bond film ever made.
Yeah, it's like 2 hours and 40 minutes, I think.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
But this one, basically, for 45 minutes, we simply have damsel after damsel sneaking into Bond's bedroom. And there's no other storyline really going on, and Diana Rigg isn't in it.
Right.
So I'm not interested in all of that.
Right.
But outside of that, yes, it had a story, it had an arc,
and it has a tragic ending. I mean, you know.
And it had a really
emotional ending
that one is just not expecting. And
Bond film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I feel like he got shafted on that one because he did a perfectly good job. And I'm not really sure what the mechanics were of why he didn't come back for a second one.
Because he didn't want to.
He didn't want to. Okay. So it was his decision.
It was his decision, apparently.
Okay.
He has been giving interviews, actually mostly about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And and he's very glib. Mm-hmm. And he talks very frankly about the whole thing. And when you're done, you just go, my God, this guy was dumb. This guy was done, for example, there was all of this stuff where he might have had a long-term relationship with Diana Rigg, but she said, but you can't be sleeping around. And he slept with every Bond girl on the set the movie and destroyed the possibility of a relationship with the woman who may help make my voice get deeper. So
he wasn't even that good looking. I mean, he's not a bad looking man.
He was a model. He was a model.
He had a cleft in the chin the size of Grand Canyon.
Yeah, yeah, yes, he did. But he was a model. I didn't see it either way. I thought Connery had was more suave.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think the suavity at that time had a lot. Daniel Craig, you wouldn't call suave.
No,
although he's the guy who can manage to do a fight scene, land on a train, and then just make sure his cuffs are in the right place.
Exactly. Well, he's described, or his character is described, as brutal often, and the fact that he has these very chiseled sort of rough looks, I think that actually fits quite well.
And Pierce Brosnan, since we've discussed all the others, up and down.
Yeah, the movie. I felt like he got it on the wrong side of things. A, he should have gotten it when Dalton got it.
That's right. Yeah, he was supposed to, but NBC held him to Remington Steele.
Remington Steele, exactly. So that's when he should have had it.
Yeah.
Second of all, they just made those movies so complicated, like needlessly complicated.
Yeah.
That you didn't always know what was going on and why it was happening. You're kind of there for the ride, and I think I was on this ride when you're done. But can you actually, I don't know that I can really tell you very much about any of the plots of those movies. I think the Koreans were involved at some point. Chinese and the Koreans, it seemed to be very Asian-based. But other than that...
I think what happened, still a broccoli movie.
Yeah, broccoli.
But I think that the markets opened up that you could now film there.
Right.
And they said, oh boy, oh boy.
Yeah, it just felt every movie was the same.
We have to use the locales.
Right, yeah. So, very little of it sticks, unfortunately, the Brosnan. I had no problem with him when he was on the screen.
And the screenplays were lightweight.
Yeah, but nothing
he
really
stuck. He was a decent Bond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the screenplays, for the most part, are lightweight.
Right, exactly.
And then with Paul Haggis, they refound their gravitas.
Yeah, once you decided to reboot it, I was very interested in that. I liked that a lot.
Yeah, no, it was a great idea for a reboot. My problem is by the beginning of Skyfall, the reboot is over. They sort of forgot that this was a reboot.
Mm-hmm.
And the most clever thing was Moneypenny.
Yeah.
And I won't give that reveal.
Yeah.
But the turnover of M was bound to happen. But the most clever thing was Moneypenny. But that's not a reboot. That's just that's a regeneration in the Doctor Who sense of regeneration. The reboot of who Bond is was sort of ended with Quantum of Solace.
Mm.
And I think that the whole point of that otherwise silly-seeming fire sequence was a metaphorical thing of he's going through the fire in order to become Bond. He's not
being forged.
Yeah, he has not yet become James Bond.
Right.
And that was the whole thing. By the time that the new people coming in finished the trilogy, they had they didn't have that train of thought.
Okay.
I'm still dwelling on that. But I talk about that a lot.
Yeah, and I should go back and watch some of those again, too. I mean, you see the same ones on TV all the time, but they don't often put some of the...
But an interesting thing, you don't have to read the whole book going clear, but read the New Yorker article.
Well, I saw the documentary, for what it's worth.
Yeah, which to me is very watered down.
Okay.
And I also have problems with the book going clear. The article, I think, nails it.
Okay.
The article is all about Paul Haggis, and there's a little bit about Tom Cruise, and there's a little bit about John Travolta. But from that, Lawrence Wright had to make a book. Mm-hmm. And I think that I don't know this, but I think that he spent a lot of time writing that original article, and that a lot of the other stuff tends to be a lot of filler. Mm-hmm. And he, I mean, he summarizes, how much is there about science fiction in the movie by the time you see the documentary going clear? Scientology comes out of science fiction.
Oh, sure.
It's created by a science fiction writer.
Right.
An important science fiction writer who was up there with Heinlein in the formative days with John W. Campbell, who published Dianetics within Astounding Tales of mm-hmm. Space and Time, I believe is the full title, not right. Analog Magazine.
Right.
For research, as far as I can tell, the only thing that Lawrence Wright he says that Hubbard dabbled in science fiction for a while.
Yeah, that's inaccurate.
And he does talk about correspondence between Hubbard and Heinlein.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all material that he got from this voluminous two-volume biography of Heinlein
mm-hmm.
that many people dispute has much accuracy in it. But that's the source material.
Oh, okay.
So, to me, the book going clear was almost a fix-up.
Mm.
And the movie is based on that book.
Right. Okay. Well, maybe I'll have to take a look at that then.
But the original article
right.
that Lawrence Wright wrote for The New Yorker, I thought was genius. I thought it was really well done and really shocking. And it doesn't discuss the Bond films at all.
Okay.
But it just Million Dollar Baby and Crash.
Mm-hmm.
But all you have to do is look at the date of the article.
Right.
And it's right after Quantum of Solace came out that Haggis quit Scientology. And when you understand how Hollywood works, Scientology is very much a force.
Okay.
In Hollywood,
mm-hmm.
was and is. So, in ways people don't begin to suspect, almost like it has a power that the Masons used to have.
Yeah.
To a large extent.
Yeah.
And they covet celebrities. Anyway.
Anyway.
But we should talk more about you again. We have been in the sense that this is what you do.
Right. This is my interests, for sure.
Yeah, and a lot of this is what you write about.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you write your nonfiction? Where do people read your blog and your thoughts?
Well, I have regular jobs with the Today Show website, so today.com.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's stuff that's on the show and we write about that, and sometimes it's more like what's interesting and trending out there.
Mm-hmm.
I write regularly for the LA Times. They have an awards season section called The Envelope, so a lot of my articles are starting to come out.
I follow that. I follow
okay.
that. I didn't notice the bylines, but I'm pretty snooty, and I'm shocked about how decent the LA Times coverage of a lot of stuff is.
Well, maybe I have a small bit to say about that.
Maybe so.
I also do the occasional stuff for Variety. It depends. It could be award season. It could be about various industry things happening mm-hmm. that are sometimes a bit dry for the average reader.
Yeah, I'm even then I read Hollywood Reporter. Rather, I get God knows how many THR announcements I get in an email per day.
Yeah.
About
they're pretty assaultive. It's true.
They really are.
So that's the main bulk. There's the occasional thing here and there, but those are the main places that I write. My website is randydawn.com, and Randy is spelled with two E's.
Yeah, RANDEEDAWN, for those who are not watching their radios.
Right, exactly. And .com, and that's where I have, I try to put my nonfiction up there. There's access to my short story book, Home for the Holidays.
Mm-hmm.
There's also access to the other book, which I co-wrote, the Law and Order SVU Unofficial Companion.
Right.
And that was co-written with Susan Green. It's dated from 2009. So if you want to know more about the recent part of the show, that's not there, but from the beginning to 2009, it's pretty comprehensive, and we got Dick Wolf to write an introduction and everything, which is great. So you can get those books there.
By the way, I've been saying this for years and years. Where in God's sake, we have every channel on cable. Where's the Law and Order channel?
You know, to me, there are two channels that I wish we could have. I want to have a Law and Order channel, which just basically keeps spooling them out. It doesn't even have to be in order necessarily.
There are enough series.
It doesn't matter.
And if you want, and if you wanted variety, you could include NCIS.
I wouldn't do that, but the thing is, you could have an NCIS. I would go for a Law and Order channel, which was just 24 hours of Law and Order episodes.
Yeah.
Then I would also go, and FXX has kind of gone a good distance to providing this, I would have 24 hours of The Simpsons. Because those are two shows where...
They're very shrewd with that FXX.
Oh, it was brilliant. And it's nice because...
It was going to be an experiment for a month, and they just haven't stopped.
No, it's great. I love being able to flip on the TV set, and there's a Simpsons, or flip on the TV set, and there's a Law and Order. It's comfort brain food. It's not quite mindless, but you can slide right into those things.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I'll come in the room, and my husband will be watching a Simpsons, and he'll start trying to explain the plot that I have currently missed. And I want to say to him, no, really... I can get this. Mm-hmm. It's The Simpsons. You just slide right into those things. My evil genius idea, which I would like to have created so much that I will share it here, and if somebody decides to make it, just, you know, maybe send me a prototype. I want MeTV. I want to be able to tell
There actually is a channel called that. But yeah.
There is, but yeah. I want to be able to tell my DVR box equivalent, whatever. These are the actors that I like. These are the shows that I like.
Yeah.
This is maybe the topics that I like, post-apocalyptic movies. And then I wanted them to just pull from all of the other 500 channels and mix it up for me.
I think we're 20 years away from that. I think we will have it.
I think we could have it now if somebody was paying attention.
Well, we could. Mm. But I'm saying the industry, you know, people, we're in a place where many of us, myself included, you know, mm-hmm. I would cut the cord.
Right.
If it wasn't for Turner Classic Movies at this point.
If we can have Pandora, the radio station, we should be able to have the equivalent of Pandora, the TV set.
Exactly. It's the economics
It's licensing and all sorts of stuff. But,
you know, I have enough. I'm turning around to take a look at my at my tech over here.
Yeah.
But, my computer is displaying a webcam mm-hmm. on the TV right now. I've got my Roku box. I've got my Chromecast.
Right.
I have my DVR. I don't have a TiVo because I consider them too expensive.
Right.
But TiVo will tell you
there's
a Cary Grant movie on.
It does just go Cary Grant?
Yeah.
Okay, because that's a big deal for me. I'm a big fan of Chris Noth from Law and Order and Good Wife and Sex and the City. I'm not necessarily a fan of all those shows.
Yeah.
But if he's in it and it's on TV, I'll probably
watch it. It would flag it.
It would flag it,
and okay. I think you can say, record all things with Chris Noth.
All the things.
yeah, and you can, now if you can do that, then you could set up, forget the DVR, you set up a stream.
Yeah, exactly. There should be a stream, the combination of Pandora for TV
YouTube.
And my iPod Shuffle. Because I want to be able to just have it running. I don't want to have to sit there and go, do I want to watch a Law and Order? Do I want to watch this? I want to just turn on MeTV and there's something playing. Something mm-hmm. that I know I want to see.
Yeah.
And so that's my please bring it up for the future before I'm in the nursing home thing.
Yeah. I don't want the shuffle. I want to determine the order. But
you can have the option. I say that there should be the option.
So the queue. For me, it's the YouTube queue, not the iPod shuffle.
Okay. See, I like the shuffle.
Because this way I can just set the order of all this. And yes, you currently have it in music. And there's no reason that you can't do it. And on YouTube,
mm-hmm.
you can do it with anything that's available through YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And now there are movies on YouTube.
Right.
And I don't know what they're doing, but all of a sudden YouTube is now YouTube Red.
Yeah, that's the pay version or something.
I don't know, but my YouTube is YouTube Red, but I'm not paying anything.
Right.
So...
Well, I feel like we're inching in this direction, and I would like to get there. But
well, we will. Yeah. We will. There's no question about it, because the standard broadcast model
mm-hmm.
is collapsing.
Yeah. Oh yeah, streaming is totally taking over. Have you heard the phrase over-the-top television.
No, I have not. I know set-top.
Over-the-top television is basically everything that does not go through your cable box or traditional broadcast outlets. Mm-hmm. So when you're watching a YouTube show, that's considered over-the-top. If you're watching Hulu or Yahoo, that's over-the-top television. I did a whole article on this. So if you haven't heard of it now, you'll have heard of it in 6 months.
Yeah, I've been doing it a long time, just haven't heard the phrase.
Exactly. So that is the phrase for it.
Acorn, by the way.
Oh, yes. I keep on getting notices about Acorn. I should watch it because it's all British TV, right?
Yeah, British and Australian, English-speaking TV, not from the U.S.
Okay. I know I need to get into that.
Miss Fisher's Mysteries on Acorn, 6 months before any other venue has it. At this point, I think Netflix has it.
Okay.
But it was on Acorn first, and there's a lot of cool stuff on Acorn that will probably be on Masterpiece Theater in a year.
Right. I dearly love my PBS, but they lose my shows. I can't find my shows on there half the time. You know, it's...
Well, I've got another anti-rap, which I shouldn't, but you see... Okay, in brief.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we paying our tax dollars and not enough tax dollars to go to England? Pardon me, that's my... and there comes my answer right now. We have so many American producers mm-hmm. that are looking for stuff. There are more Ken Burnses out there. There are more people like that, more dogs outside my house, and stuff like that. That, you know, I just want, give me those, I'll pay for the BBC. Give me the BBC. I don't need PBS to distill the BBC. And I don't care for BBC America with all the commercials. I want the BBC. I'll pay for that. I want the public broadcasting system, government-run American TV, to be American producers. This isn't, I like both. So, and then, why is it that Congress short funds PBS and NPR mm-hmm. so that they have to figure out how, now, we're Pacifica Radio. Mm-hmm. We were made to beg. We invented listener sponsorship mm-hmm. in 1946. We were the first. They're modeling after us. They shouldn't be. They are government radio and government television. We mm-hmm. are non-government in any way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
They should not be begging us for money. They should be taking our money from our taxes and putting it into those channels, supporting them to mm-hmm. the extent where they can be producing the best television possible and offering us, and they can offer us as an extra BBC.
Right.
BBC World. There is such a thing. They get it in Canada. Mm-hmm. Why don't we get it here?
More licensing issues.
But figure out those licensing issues and pay for them instead of our tax dollars going to Masterpiece Theater and Masterpiece Mystery and the rest of the British shows.
I love those British shows, though.
So do I. So figure out the licensing issues and, you know, and that's a checkbox on your taxes if mm-hmm. you want to pay for that. I do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm totally happy
yeah.
to do that. I've got no problems with
hopefully
that.
Enough people would be.
And there's Acorn.
There's Acorn. Right, exactly.
So you can get it.
Mm-hmm.
You're just not getting it through our tax dollars.
Right.
And that's the point. PBS is funded by Congress, but only to a small extent.
Yes.
Then they have to go to corporate funding, and the corporate funding hinders their programming.
Mm-hmm.
Some of my favorite PBS shows in the earliest days of PBS, like The Great American Dream Machine, were taken off the air because they did some anti-car stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they're funded by Exxon and Mobil and Ford.
Right.
And places like that help determine the programming.
Mm-hmm.
That's wrong. Neither the government nor the corporations should be determining the programming.
Right.
I
agree.
The BBC works.
Yeah.
And that's government TV. Why don't we have a BBC on PBS?
Right. Yeah, we need to have that whole other conversation another time because there's a whole thing I could talk about broadcast as well.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a whole different rant.
Yeah, it is. There, silence. We should get to, you were going to read something for us.
Yeah.
Or you can come back.
Well,
because we've actually done more than a show's worth of material right there.
Right.
I leave it up to you. The advantage of coming back would be that we could record your reading under more studio conditions.
Ah, I see. Sure, I'd be happy to come back and do a reading then.
Once again, let me thank you for being here, Randy Dawn.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the portal to all things Randy Dawn is...
randydawn.com, which is spelled RANDEEDAWN.com.
And you will be on this show again, no doubt. And also occasionally doing movie reviews.
Sure.
You've done one for me. We have to do more.
Yeah, we do. We do.
Yeah, we do.
To coordinate that better.
Okay. So thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
And that was an interview with Randy Dawn, recorded a week ago Tuesday for this program. And she will be back sometime very soon to read us some of her fiction. We just got two... much fun talking about these various things, and I hope that you enjoyed that as well. Join us again for Hour of the Wolf next week at 1:30 a.m. when my guest will be David Barr Kirtley. Have a wonderful Turkey Day, and please, everybody, for once, worldwide, be good to each other. Take care.
And you're in tune to Rider Station WBAI, WBAI, 99.5 FM New York, WBAI.org. Thank you, Jim Freund. And it's a minute and a half in front of 3 o'clock. Burn, baby, burn. Crystal Live up next, right here at 99 Synchro WBAI.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover.
This is Saul Williams.
And this is Michael Freund from Spearhead.
And this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
This is Reverend Jesse Jackson of the Rainbow Push Coalition. Please call and support WBAI, Non-Commercial Peace and Justice Radio in New York.
People moving out, people moving in. Why? Because of the color of the skin. Run, 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 but you sure can hide. Yeah, yeah, let me hear you, let me hear.
From November 27th through December 13th, join us at the Chelsea Bowtie Cinema, Mist Harlem, and Teachers College to celebrate 23 years of the African Diaspora International Film Festival. Discover films from more than 28 countries about the human experience of people of color. For more information on screenings, panels, events, and ticket prices, go to nyadiff.org.